The title of this conference by Father John Hardin is Witness Through the Beatitudes. Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin has been a consultant to the consortium from its beginning and is closely associated with its interests as a communication enterprise for religious women in the United States. Father Hardin.
Witness through the Beatitudes. We have so far seen something of the meaning of witness in our religious life. We saw that according to the late council, religious are a necessary part of the church, not to be underestimated, because the people of God need our witness to things of the spirit, to the supernatural and the celestial. We also saw how earnestly Pope Paul urges religious to remain faithful to their calling, because today's secularized world needs our witness, testifying, as we saw, to the vision of God, which we must first have experienced in order to raise people's hope beyond the vision of man, that is, from earth to heaven and from space and time to eternity. We now wish to see how we are to give this important witness. In other words, if we're to give it, the question is how. In other words, this being a retreat, we want not only to know what to do, which can be got in other places and other times, but how to do it. For me, the essence of a retreat is methodology. The way, fortunately, has been mapped out by our Savior in the 8 Beatitudes which he preached to his disciples, and which, and this is the middle term, the council says is the synthesis of the religious life. So the picture is that we have the way in which we are to witness by practicing, living out the Beatitudes. Why the Beatitudes? Well, because the church tells us, and that's why it has been so important to establish the church's authority on the religious life. A good synthesis of this life of the councils is living the Beatitudes. This is so true, says the council, that the religious life might be redefined, which it redefines, as that state in which a person commits himself to a lifelong practice of the Beatitudes. Clearly, in one sense, and in some degree, all Christians are expected, betimes, to practice the Beatitudes. But not all receive the grace to live these Beatitudes for a lifetime. And what is even more significant, to commit themselves to live the life of the Beatitudes until death. My plan is to spend two conferences on the Beatitudes, namely the present one and the next one. In the first, we want to see how the Beatitudes, if lived out faithfully, become our witness to the world. As a religious life is supposed to be according to the mind of the Church. In the next conference, we will look at the Beatitudes themselves. Our question this morning, then, is to ask, how do the Beatitudes serve as a witness to the world of the truth of Christ's teaching? Now, here I may sound a bit complicated, and if I am, it's because I'm complicated, not because the teaching is difficult. Christ's teaching is simple. Theologians complicate it. Notice what we are saying. We are still on the introduction, kind of a long one. We are saying that the world needs to be shown that Christ's teaching is true and good, and therefore to be followed. It needs to be shown that Christ is worth following. It should be convinced. Secondly, the world, being logical, demands evidence or proof. Then, living the Beatitudes offers such evidence. Now, as you know, it takes only a few minutes to say something. It often takes hours. And in the case of Revelation, will take a whole eternity to unravel it. The world needs to be convinced that Christ is worth following. It wants evidence or proof. Show me, or us. Living the Beatitudes offers such evidence. How? What I will do is cover four aspects of this simple and yet complex subject. Because let's face it, as we get into a subject as rich as witnessing to Christ in the modern world, in one sense we are treading on new ground. Nothing really that new about it, because we know that Christ has always wanted us to do it. But just in the shape or form in which we are approaching the subject, the language is new. And consequently, it needs more than ordinary explanation. The four stages that I will try to cover, and I'm watching the clock, will be first to see something of the universal human desire for happiness. Then, to see what the philosophy of the world is on how happiness is to be achieved. Then, what is the philosophy of Christ on how you get happy? And then, the mucilage between this conference and the next one, so the two hold together, to look briefly at how the Beatitudes, which are a synthesis of Christ's philosophy of happiness serve as a witness to the world that needs convincing. The universal desire for happiness. This is like talking about beauty. In fact, it's worse. Happiness is even more universal. You can't define it. You can't even describe it. You can only experience it. All we want to see, or better, remind ourselves of, is that nothing is more universal in the human race than man's desire for happiness. It is reflected in the cry of a newborn babe, which feels some physical discomfort, and without being able to speak, cries out for relief and the comfort of loving hands. It is reflected in the search for attention from those around us as we grow out of infancy into childhood. It is seen in our desire for affection from parents, brothers and sisters, relatives, and friends. It is seen in our longing for companionship, which most people look for in marriage, and others, like ourselves, in the company of kindred spirits, with whom we can share the intimacies and confidences of friendship. It is reflected in our desire for a long life and health, for recognition, and the sense of achievement in work well done. So the list could go on. With no exception, from infancy into old age, in every land and every language of human speech, man's desire for happiness is unquestionable, even when, as generally, it is undefinable, and most people seldom reflect on what happiness is. Or less still, on the fact that every human action they perform is a quest for the goal of man's existence and a search for the fulfillment of his being. So much is common knowledge and fills the libraries of all countries with books describing this quest and search, and often its tragic failure, with varying degrees of success, and, in most cases, the best literature of men and women searching for happiness and dying before they had found it. I think we need a periodic reflection like this. The reason is because before we begin to divide into the two philosophies of happiness, so far we are all the same. The hunger in the human heart is unique and univocal. In other words, the same. The only difference in on this, everything else rests. And the purpose of our witness depends. It is not a question of our witnessing to a world to convince it that it should want happiness. Follow this. These words are not obvious. No one needs testimony to that. We are born with that hunger as we die with it. The only question and therefore the only function of our witness can be as to where that happiness is to be found. So we look now at the second stage of our reflection. Given this universal desire for happiness, it was inevitable that men should have developed various philosophies of happiness. In other words, as to how the goal, being happiness, is to be achieved. Which, by the way, is one of my several definitions of philosophy. Systematic analysis of how a man can achieve happiness. Ultimately, all these philosophies can be reduced to two. The one we may call the mortal philosophy of happiness. The other, the immortal. We reserve the second for the next conference. Now a word about the first. This philosophy may be called the mortal philosophy of happiness, or a synonym, which may help, the secular, this worldly philosophy. Or another synonym, terrestrial, or again, temporal. What is it? It says, in by now thousands of books and in millions of lives, that man's life is strictly mortal, which is not quite accurate, because we all believe that man's life is mortal. That's not quite the mortal philosophy of happiness. To be really correct, we should say it is the philosophy of anti-mortal happiness. In other words, that there is only a life up to mortem, up to death. That post-mortem there is nothing. Again, it says that man's life is uniquely secular, from the Latin for world, saeculum. That is limited to this world of sense and smell, taste and touch and feeling. Again, that man's life is only terrestrial, limited to this place and no other. And I think I feel safe in saying this, even though we have reached the moon, I still call it terrestrial for a lot of reasons. Because you've got to take all kinds of terrestrial apparatus with you. And if you don't, then it would be what I am tempted to call the flights to the moon. though I'm not quite literal in saying this, a form of lunacy. Don't misunderstand me. Most of you know that I did finish my graduate studies at an engineering school. I'm much too much in love with science to underestimate the great advancements. For our purpose, it is still terrestrial. They have still got to come back. That we can never reach, and notice my words now, travelable space. And even if they reach Mars, I can still use this conference, though I just wrote it this morning. And finally, we're talking about the philosophy of this worldly happiness, or the philosophy of happiness, which we call secular, that man's life is absolutely temporal. By the way, it might be well to define time. We seldom do it. You know what time is? Time has been best defined by the philosophers as the measure of change. The measure of change. So what do? We cut up the various changes in our life into small pieces, which we call seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, and years. These pieces put together finally end. No more change, and therefore nothing more to measure. After that, nothing. Other people simply go through the same short spanned course of time. That we called the world's philosophy of happiness. Now we wish to look at Christ's philosophy of happiness. It is, as we believe, just the opposite. And by the way, John's Gospel, where Christ contrasts himself and the world, bears rereading. There is no question whatsoever. We'd have to be out of our minds to say anything else, that we are living in this world. Of course. Period. That's a complete sentence. But living in this world does not mean necessarily living according to this world. As though this world were all there is. Throughout Revelation, and most lucidly in the New Testament, best of all in John, no personal prejudice. It's just that he's got the best on the subject. We are told in no uncertain terms that our lives do not end with death, are not limited to this world, are not confined to what can be seen or heard or even conceived by the human mind. They are not temporal. On the contrary, we are creatures of flesh indeed. Who doubts it? Look what we've got to do 3 times a day, sisters. You don't like to think about it, but we've got to do it. 3 times a day, we've got to open an aperture, which is called the mouth. And we've got to take from the herbs of the earth, from the flesh and muscle of animal, from the fruits of trees, We do various things with it. Cut it up, boil it, fry it. Then, very ritually, oh, we surround this with a lot of fanfare to cover up what we are really doing. China, silverware, just so, neat tablecloth. What do? We take chunks of flesh, bits of grass, and we put it into the aperture. We close the mouth, we masticate, and we swallow. And we better do it. God's way of keeping us humble. So we are creatures of flesh and blood, all right. That was not in my notes. But we are also spirit that will never die. That even our flesh and blood are one day destined to be reunited with our spirit, to live on forever. That we are persons individually made by God to be individuals, and that means to be ourselves. Don't worry, sisters. In spite of all the efforts of our best meant friends to shape us to what they are, to change us, God is master of our destiny. We will remain ourselves into endless eternity. And we better be ourselves, because we want to be around to enjoy it. So much then, by way of contrast, the world's philosophy of happiness and Christ's, clearly quite different basis. Now, anticipating what we are going to take up in the next meditation, how precisely are the Beatitudes a synthesis of this philosophy of Christ? Philosophy of what? Of how you achieve that which everybody wants to get. They are, first of all, 8 promises. Now, the versions, as you know, differ. There are 8 and 4. I prefer the 8. They're more detailed. And no doubt, more specifically, Luke's is a summary. I'm following Matthew. They are 8 promises of beatitude. Now, as you know, our English language is a hybrid. And that, by the way, is a very kind word. When I feel bad about it, I call it the mongrel language.
This conference is continued on Side B.